You are listening to We Saw the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and WeSawTheDevil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. You are listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin. And today's episode is the result of a little switcheroo. As stated at the beginning of last week, I even put a clue up as far as what the next episode would be, but then I got really, really sick. You may be able to still hear a little bit of the congestion, which is also kind of affecting my ability to enunciate words. So I sound a little off at times. But yeah, I apologize for the delay. Super sick. I actually finally ended up getting my very first COVID test, which was negative, but they really do scrub your brains, don't they? That was painful. And likewise, I hope all of you are staying safe, and it seems like things are getting crazy out there once again, huh? That being said, let's just get our quick housekeeping out of the way for the day. So, as always, you can find us at WeSawTheDevil.com, We Saw the Devil across social media. And if you're interested in backing the show, getting some goodies, postcards, things like that, merch, you can do that at our Patreon by backing us for as little as $3 a month. That's patreon.com/WeSawTheDevil. And as always, please, if you love a podcast, again, not just mine, but if you love a podcast, the best and most important thing that you guys can do for us is to leave a 5-star review. It means the world, not only to our egos, guys, those aside. It has to do with marketing, metrics, things like that, because, you know, the content and whatnot that we put out is largely free, other than, you know, little ways that we can monetize. So it is really, really important to show your support in that way. Alrighty, so let's talk about the Suzanne Morphew case. I have been following this case closely since it came into national media, and more or less, just a quick recap, is that Suzanne Morphew was a mom, 2 daughters, led what appeared to be a wonderful, privileged life with her husband, Barry. They lived in Colorado in a multi-million dollar home. They had another home in Indiana that they left to pursue their dream in Colorado. To the outside world, everything looked perfect. Suzanne apparently set out for a bike ride on Mother's Day morning, and has never been seen or heard from again. Her husband, Barry, obviously the husband is always the first suspect, right? Because 9 times out of 10, it's, you know, the husband or a boyfriend. Sad, but true. Her husband, Barry, just rubbed everyone the wrong way. People could see that he was a narcissist, that his mannerisms weren't normal. Behavioral analysts have even broken it down. You can watch many of those videos on YouTube. And they're like, yeah, this guy is not telling the truth. He made this really uncomfortable, impassioned plea for her return, and it just felt so off. Like, my Suzanne, I miss you. Please come home. If someone has her, please bring her back. I mean, that's exactly what he sounded like. So it was no surprise then that Barry was arrested for her murder. But what's so interesting about it, at least to me, is that there is almost zero evidence. So there is zero evidence as far as forensic evidence. There's no blood. There's no body. There are no remains. To everyone's knowledge, there's not even a murder weapon. She just disappeared. So Barry Morphew's preliminary hearing started yesterday, Monday the 9th. And this hearing will be taking place yesterday, so Monday the 9th, today the 10th, the 23rd, and then the 24th. So there is a break in between. If you are in or near Chaffee County, Colorado, you can actually go to the courtroom and watch. You can actually be inside the courtroom. There's also overflow outside at the fairgrounds. The judge, in fact, has allowed visitors to be there physically. Unfortunately, the judge is not allowing it to be televised or broadcast online. He mentioned that in previous press conferences that have been broadcast, there have been a lot of trolls, negative or profane comments, and due to the sheer amount of traffic, the volume of the traffic that would likely take over court servers, they're just not going to do it. And that's unfortunate. So what we're going to do today is we're going to do a recap of day 1 and the explosive new details that came out of the first day. So to recap, again, Suzanne Morphew went missing on Mother's Day, May 10th of last year, and she's never been found. Barry Morphew was arrested, and he has been charged with the following: murder in the first degree, tampering with a deceased human body, tampering with physical evidence, possession of a dangerous weapon, in this case a short rifle, attempt to influence a public servant, forgery of public records, and misdemeanor elections mail ballot offense. So 7 different charges that Barry Morphew has been charged with. And he's suspected of murdering Suzanne, but we've had absolutely no glimpse at any sort of evidence supporting law enforcement's theory and accusations. And that's what this preliminary hearing is for. The judge will be hearing evidence against Barry Morphew in order to determine whether he will stand trial for Suzanne's murder. Evidence gathering in the case was kept secret before the hearing. You know, the Lori Vallow case, there have been a lot of leaks. A lot of information has spilled out and come out. Not so with the Suzanne Morphew case. There's a 130-page court document outlining the reasons for Barry's arrest. Now, that was sealed. Despite opposition, pretty much like every single major news network and organization known to man gave, everyone was fighting it. But the original document outlining all of the reasons of why they arrested him was 130 pages. And this preliminary hearing is actually going through and using this affidavit as a guide. So that's actually what's really interesting about all of this, is we're finally learning the evidence and what exactly brought us to this point. So let's talk about day one of this preliminary hearing. The first witness to take the stand was Commander Alex Walker with the Chaffee County Sheriff's Office. And he told the court that Mallory Morphew, one of Barry and Suzanne's daughters, reached out to a neighbor when her mom didn't respond to her Happy Mother's Day text on Mother's Day. Now, Mallory and Macy Morphew, the two sisters, they had actually gone on a road trip together and were away. So they wanted to text their mom, say, "Hey, mom, love you. Happy Mother's Day." But they didn't actually receive a response. That was very, very, very much unlike Suzanne. She was constantly on her phone, constantly in contact with her daughters, and it just was not normal behavior. So Mallory and Macy contacted one of their neighbors and asked them to go check on her. And that is how police involvement in this case began. Reportedly, Suzanne left her home over the weekend on Mother's Day in the morning for a bike ride. She had recently gotten into mountain biking, and where their home is located is prime real estate and some of the best in the country for mountain biking. So on May 10th, Chaffee County Deputy Brown responded to the Morphew home and found her bicycle shortly after getting dispatched. Now, he immediately turned on his body camera when he got to Highway 50 and County Road 225. That's where the bike was found. And in this preliminary hearing, the video was actually shown to the courtroom of this body cam footage and him talking and finding the bicycle. He audibly notes in this video that there was no blood, no skid marks, no brake marks, no struggle, and no damage to the bicycle at all. As this video was being played, Mallory and Macy Morphew were holding hands and sobbing, and they were seated behind their father, Barry. The bike itself, now the bike was laying sideways on a very steep hill when they found it. And I mean, we're talking where the bike was found. I mean, it was surrounded by thick aspen and fir trees. There was no actual visible trail in the area. So suspicions off the rails here, because there wasn't even a trail that Suzanne would have taken in the area to begin with. But on the body cam footage, the deputies who showed up talk about different scenarios as far as what could have happened. One of them begins to contact local hospitals, and another starts screaming and yelling for Suzanne, calling her name. When the deputies initially arrived at the Morphew home later that day, Miles Harvey, Macy Morphew's boyfriend, was walking out of the Morphew's garage. And he told detectives that the Morphew daughters were not at home and that Macy had called him to go by the house to check for their mom, to look for their mom. She was getting worried. So he and his father did. And Miles said that Suzanne would never have gone up the trail where her bike was found because it was a crazy climb and too steep for, you know, a middle-aged woman on a mountain bike who was new to mountain biking to go up by herself. Suzanne was very, very strong and also an avid biker, but she also was undergoing cancer treatments, which we'll discuss that more later. Miles and his father then told the deputies where Suzanne typically went biking, as that's typically, you know, where she went. So not only that, but Miles said that Suzanne typically loaded her bike into her car before driving to a trailhead to go biking. She very, very, very rarely just said, hey, I'm just going to go for a little, you know, a little bike ride and I'll be back. She almost always loaded her bicycle into the car and then took it somewhere. So separate locations. The deputy then asked Miles what Barry and Suzanne's relationship was like, and Miles explained that they've had some problems in the past, and they've even talked about separating. I've known this through Macy. So, red flag number one. Also reiterated, was Suzanne's cell phone's last ping was at 4:23 a.m. on the morning of the 10th, Mother's Day. It pinged from a cell tower about 10 miles east of Maysville. Her phone was not at home at 4:23 a.m. the day that she went missing. And then the court also played the body cam footage of Barry Morphew arriving to the scene at about 8:46. This was also played. He got out of his truck and asked where was the bike, and then asked deputies if there had been some kind of crash. Now, when Commander Walker talked with Barry the following day on May 11th, Barry said that he and Suzanne had had a great day. He's called Suzanne his angel since he was 17 years old, and they love each other to death. And he told investigators that their relationship was very good and that they'd been together for 32 years. Now, when Commander Walker was asking him, you know, like, what do you think happened? Apparently, Barry Morphew told him that there was a local RV park that was sketchy and that he should check that out. And then was like, oh, or maybe she was attacked by a mountain lion. And then he stated that his, quote, his worst scare was someone picking her up. But Suzanne knew what she was doing, and she didn't ever leave the house without her Camelback, you know, her water pack, or her sunglasses. Both her Camelback and her sunglasses were found in her car, in her Range Rover. And then Commander Walker discussed just the sheer size of the search for Suzanne. Aircrafts, drones, grid searches, canines, mine checks, ground-penetrating radar, water teams. And at this point, within 2 days of Suzanne's disappearance, there were more than 10 agencies involved in her search. And those searches are actually still going on today. They actually just recently investigated and cleared a mine in case she either fell down or was thrown into it. So Commander Walker talked for quite a bit and walked through the investigation in the early stages. And then Drew Nielsen, Barry's defense attorney, cross-examined Commander Walker. She asked if he authorized that 130-page arrest affidavit, how long it took him to write, when he started writing it. And what's interesting is that Commander Walker actually began writing this document on May 11th, literally the day after Suzanne disappeared. Barry was that immediate suspect in law enforcement's mind. And then Nielsen had Commander Walker confirm a variety of facts. That Suzanne's blood had not been found in the Morphew home. Not only was her blood not in the home, but there has been zero blood evidence found in this case whatsoever. He also confirmed that the scene where Suzanne's bike had been found was never cordoned off. It wasn't protected from outside influence, traffic. So therefore, there was heavy foot traffic from investigators, search teams, family, and friends. It's also important to note that Barry Morphew never contacted the police regarding Suzanne's disappearance. 8 whole hours passed from the time that Barry Morphew texted Suzanne that morning to wish her a happy Mother's Day to the time that neighbors reached out to him when Macy and Mallory contacted them looking for their mother. And Commander Walker also noted and made sure to enforce the fact that Barry never once called the police. Also in this case, there were more than 110 search warrants issued. The first search warrant was on May 11th of 2020, just 1 day after Suzanne went missing. And that one also included the vehicles. All of the family members were removed from the home, and then it was given back to them on May 20th. So none of them actually had the ability to gather belongings, clothing, or personal effects. The second search of the home happened on July 9th and included 14 FBI officers, 7 CBI agents, and 6 Chaffee County deputies. But let's get into the details that I find so interesting. Guys, never in a million years did I think that this would have been introduced to a case, because it's the first time I've ever seen it. But we have a spy pen. A spy pen is involved. Apparently, Suzanne Morphew and her friend Sheila Oliver exchanged many, 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 many text messages. I mean, of course they did. They were best friends. They were college roommates. They've known each other for over 30 years. At this point in the preliminary hearing, this is when we start getting into Suzanne's personal life, how she was interacting with friends. This is an inside view to Suzanne's world. And some of the most important text messages between the two of them happened between September of 2019 and March of 2020. And in court, they just started projecting these text messages up onto the screen. So in one message, Suzanne told Sheila, quote, says he loves me and can't handle the pain from me not giving him the love he needs. Does not mention all the damage he's done to me, physically, mentally. In another text, she wrote, quote, told him I'm done, that I need peace, not sure what's next, end quote. And he tries to use money as a tool and the girls. I didn't take the bait. And earlier I mentioned that she was battling cancer. Well, she was getting cancer treatments. She was still undergoing these treatments after fighting off Hodgkin's lymphoma not only once, but twice. And apparently, Barry would hang money over her head and ask her how she expected to pay for her cancer treatments if they ended up getting divorced. In another text to Sheila, Suzanne referred to Barry as Jekyll and Hyde, saying, quote, he won't speak of divorce, begging for another chance. I'm so torn, but in my heart, I know who he is. And Suzanne apparently suspected that Barry was having an affair. So she and Sheila discussed this at length, and Sheila suggested that she should get a spy pen, one of those little voice-activated writing pens, in order to get an answer about it, basically spy on Barry. And for those of you who don't know, they're like little black pens, and they have basically like a USB, a micro USB plug on one end, so you can plug it into your computer and download audio. And you can buy them in various sizes and storage capacities. But it activates when voices are heard. So police found this spy pen in Suzanne's closet on June 2nd. There were 11 deleted files and 11 saved files. Suzanne did in fact buy this pen, and she actually put it in Barry Morphew's truck. Here's the kicker though. It didn't actually pick up any evidence from Barry Morphew. Apparently, Barry was never found to have been having an affair. Investigators still do not believe that he was actively having an affair and couldn't actually see any time that he has had an affair. And that's despite the fact that a woman by the name of Annie Velasquez came forward shortly after this case went public. She actually had proof that she had connected with Barry Morphew on a dating app. On this app, he was apparently going by the name Jim, and they connected in February of 2020. That's 3 months before Suzanne's disappearance. Now, this pen did, however, pick up such evidence from Suzanne. Suzanne had been having an affair with a man named Jeff Libler. Now, she and Jeff had gone to high school together in Alexandria, Indiana, and law enforcement found out about the affair in November of 2020. Suzanne and Jeff met up 6 times, including twice in Indiana, and apparently they were also planning potentially to meet in New Orleans. Suzanne would meet with him when she would go on trips, business trips, sometimes, and talk to him when she would go visit her father. What's so interesting is that Suzanne didn't tell anyone about this affair. Her family, her friends, not even her bestie Sheila, she told no one about this affair. And Jeff himself didn't even come forward to law enforcement, even after Suzanne stopped responding and then the case made international news. Investigators had to discover this on their own based on LinkedIn messages and also the spy pen. Jeff claimed that he didn't come forward because, well, A, he himself, he's a married man, supposedly happily married man and father of 6 children, but also because he didn't want Suzanne's legacy to be one of cheating and salacious affairs. And that is shocking to a lot of people. And then Drew Nielsen, again, Barry's defense attorney, she continued through the rest of the affidavit. She had actually given both the state and the judge a packet of the exhibits that they planned to show. This includes security camera footage and a very long log of Barry's work truck, like when the doors opened and closed. On May 10th, from 2:47 a.m. to 5:30 a.m., again, that's very, very, very early morning on Mother's Day, Barry Morphew took steps in disposing of evidence according to activity on cell phones and in his truck, the truck data. On page 2 of the arrest affidavit, basically law enforcement says that they have enough as evidence, you know, beyond basically more or less a doubt, reason of suspicion, that Barry was up between 2 and 5 a.m. Barry had a very specific work truck, and the internal data actually showed when the doors opened and closed. So all of this data actually shows him lying and being up and awake and going places from, you know, roughly 3 to 5:30. Then Nielsen discussed the security surveillance system installed on the Morphy residence. Apparently, it had not been operational for a couple years. There were missing cables. Barry said that he had never touched it and told investigators that he, quote, would bet $100,000 that she was the one who unplugged it. She, obvious reference to Suzanne. So the defense team is showing that it was likely Suzanne who disabled their security system. There was a blue cable that was missing. Law enforcement found it. They ran this cable. They searched it for DNA. They obtained it and they sent it to a lab. Now, this power cable did come back a DNA mixture with two people, Suzanne, and then also an unknown male individual. Nielsen then brought up Suzanne's Range Rover. Barry actually sold that in Indiana 2 months after she went missing, because that's normal, right? Police obviously impounded and searched that Range Rover, and DNA was found on the glove box and sent for testing. Barry Morphew's DNA was not on that glove box. There was a hit, though, made on DNA from, again, an unknown male, with 3 sexual assaults on his record. And then that's as far as Drew Nielsen went with it. She gave no additional rhyme, reason, logic as far as why she brought that up in court, other than maybe to sow doubt. But I want to know, like, what happened with this random man whose DNA was found on her glove box, who was convicted of 3 rapes? Like, can we talk maybe more about that and why his DNA was in Suzanne Morphew's car? But unfortunately, we don't have the answer to that yet. And after making that statement, that's basically when the defense ended and concluded their line of questioning. So then Commander Walker was cross-examined by District Attorney Linda Stanley. And then Commander Walker was like, see, Barry Morphew told us and claimed to have left his home at 5 a.m. to go to Broomfield. However, that data from the truck, you know, the one that shows door activities, shows that at 3:26 it opened, and then again at 8:10 a.m. Barry initially told the investigators that he left that house around 5 a.m. And that is a lie, because his cell phone activity began to ping at 2:47 a.m. And then he had car activity at 3:26 a.m. And then again at 8:10. Barry initially told them that he left at 5. That's a lie. So there we have at least the very first big piece of this where Barry Morphew was caught in an absolute lie. So the next person up was FBI agent Ken Harris. Now, he took the stand and he was immediately questioned about the spy pen, which, I mean, obviously at this point, like, we all want to know about the spy pen. What is on the spy pen? And this is really creepy, guys. I mean, this is just, like, chilling. One of the recordings from this pen, it's from February or March of 2020. It's unknown the exact day. It's a Barry Morphew driving. He's not talking, but he's just listening to the radio, specifically news on true crime, criminal cases, different stories. Part of this recording is of a news story where someone went missing while riding a bike and they actually had been murdered. Now, again, this is within like 3 to 4 months of Suzanne Morphew going missing. And then here again, to recap for those of you who may have missed this, here is a spy pen that Suzanne Morphew placed in her husband's truck to catch him having an affair. And in actuality, it caught him listening to a true crime news story outlining a case that is specifically how his own wife went missing. Now, another recording on the spy pen was 5 hours long, and it was of Suzanne speaking with Jeff Libler. In this recording, Suzanne and Jeff discuss marriage, how they want to get married. Suzanne says, biblically, I am not allowed to. I'm married. I can't marry you. And Jeff's like, no, let's just move to Ecuador. It's cheap. There's great health care. We can take care of your cancer and your cancer treatments and don't have to worry about money. Per Suzanne's computer, Suzanne did later, in fact, research language schools in Ecuador. She actually researched English and, you know, and Spanish language schools in Ecuador. From there, Agent Harris discussed more text messages between Sheila and Suzanne, because being best friends, that was literally the best window into kind of Suzanne's circumstances, what was going on in her personal life. In one message, Suzanne told Sheila, quote, "He's unstable." And she frequently expressed fears that Barry would turn their daughters against her. Many times she said that he will basically present one face to their daughters and turn them against her. That, you know, her daughters were more or less daddy's girls. Agent Harris actually interviewed Sheila Oliver directly. And Sheila claimed that Barry had a habit of trying to get the girls on his side and pit the girls against Suzanne entirely. Once, Sheila told the agent, Barry Morphew threw Suzanne into a closet and put a loaded gun to his own head, asking her if that was what she wanted. Another message Suzanne sent Sheila said, quote, "I would live in a shack right now. I'm sure he won't make it easy. He has always wanted control." She also told Sheila that Barry Morphew controlled what she wore, that sometimes she wasn't even allowed to wear certain clothing. And then at this point in the preliminary hearing, more screenshots and spy pen recordings are either played or shown. So in one recording from the spy pen, Suzanne said, "You are the sweetest thing I've ever known. Cannot live my life without you in it." And then Jeff Libler left a message to Suzanne that says, "Baby, you are a sweetheart. This boy craves you. Everything about you." In February, Suzanne said to Jeff, that was picked up in the spy pen, "Maybe we are in the clear for Valentine's Day. Barry won't be around then." Now, Jeff did mention that Suzanne had told him that Barry had seen some of the messages and that they needed to switch out which chat apps they used for communicating. But there's no evidence that Barry knew about it. So Sheila and other people close to the case don't believe that Barry actually knew. From what has been said so far, they primarily actually used LinkedIn to communicate. Suzanne actually reactivated her LinkedIn profile, and that is how she and Jeff primarily communicated. They even sent nudes to one another, love messages. They talked all the time. But that is it for day one, guys. The spy pen stuff, never seen that, never heard of that being used in a case, and it definitely added on a whole new layer onto this case that I think a lot of us weren't exactly prepared for, that is for sure. But I'm personally very, very interested in the timeline of this. On May 9th, 2:47 is the start time of this affidavit against Barry Morphew. What happened at 2:47 p.m. the day before Mother's Day? We do know, based on this preliminary hearing, that Suzanne was messaging with Jeff Libler at 2:11 p.m., just 30 minutes before. Did Barry Morphew discover the affair? Did Barry Morphew discover the affair, and that's what led to this chain of events? It is now 12:45 on Tuesday, and I am actually recording this as day two is going, as it is actively happening in court. So after today, there will be a couple week break, like a week and a half break. And then on the, I believe I said 23rd and 24th, this preliminary hearing will kick back up and we'll have a couple more days. Yeah, it is crazy. For some reason, I'm much more invested in Suzanne Morphew. I'm going to be completely honest, guys. I'm far more invested in Suzanne Morphew's case than Lori Vallow's case. I will say it. I don't know why. You know, Barry Morphew has I believe he was a construction contractor, but he has a bobcat and he has all of this equipment. Now, law enforcement did actually say that his bobcat, like his construction equipment, was not used in the crime. Apparently, they had forensic analysts come out and analyze everything. But there's a lot more to this story. There is a lot more to the story. I could even do a full two episodes on what happened, actions, and the follow-up, because Barry, it took a long time for Barry to get arrested. He was only arrested a couple months ago. And this happened over a year and three months ago. So a lot has happened. Maybe I will. It's a really interesting case because not only do we have virtually no evidence whatsoever as far as forensics that we're aware of, at least, but we also now have introduction of a spy pen and then also an affair. So, which in my opinion, what little it matters is if you've seen true crime cases like this before, the most dangerous time in a romantic relationship is when you bring up divorce or the discovery of an affair. So, you know, I think that maybe we're starting to see some development of potential motives here. But that is it for today, guys. I'm actually going to be bringing you two more episodes this week. I'm going to be doing day two of this preliminary hearing for the Suzanne Morphew case. I need to catch up on news from that. Multiple people actually messaged me asking where they can watch it. You can't. I'm actually getting this and compiling things from about five different sources of people who were in the courtroom. So I'm basically taking all of these firsthand accounts from journalists and bringing them all together, trying to give the biggest fleshed out view that I possibly can. So the next episode is going to be part two of that for this preliminary hearing. And then also the episode related to the clue that I put out on our Facebook and Instagram. There has been some minor Lori Vallow news, guys, but not enough to do an episode on. And I'm actually going to, kind of just being honest here, downgrade our coverage of the Lori Vallow case until probably trial or something else just absolutely crazy happens. There's no use doing a full episode on something with such little information. And there are a lot more cases that I would like to cover. But that is it for today. Thank you for listening. Don't forget, you can follow us at We Saw the Devil basically across all social media channels. Our Patreon is patreon.com/WeSawTheDevil. And please, if you are enjoying our show, coverage, anything like that, please leave a 5-star review. You can do that on Apple, iTunes, or even from your computer. Until next crime.